You are listening to KOWSLP Occidental 92.5 FM, serving Santa Rosa and West Sonoma County for 18 years, streaming to the world at kowsfm.com from our studios in Santa Rosa, California. You can visit our website to listen, donate, or volunteer. Our email address is kows@sonic.net. You can also download the Radio Rethink streaming app from the App Store.
COWS Radio thanks Community Market of Sebastopol for their ongoing support. Community Market is a worker-run natural food store providing our community with organic food products since 1975. Located at the Barlow, 6762 Sebastopol Avenue in Sebastopol, you can reach them by phone at area code 707-407-4020.
We thank Mac Daddy Repairs for their ongoing support. They are a West County computer and phone repair center featuring on-site and remote support. They're located at 301 North Main Street in Sebastopol and can be reached by email at support@macdaddyrepairs.com. or by phone at 707-861-9403.
Hello and welcome back. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and I'm your host, Andrew Lewis. For those of you who are just joining us, be forewarned, this is a Shaggy Dog story that has been going on for a whole bunch of months now. It's about San Diego in the 1990s and a long walk and about an artist and an installation done in a small chapel in San Diego many decades ago. If you want to dial in to the beginning of the story, I strongly encourage you to go to Spotify and search for The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and you should be able to bring up all the past episodes. That should get you up to speed. So here we are, the beginning of summer. We have a massive heat wave hitting us here in West Sonoma County. Some of you may be aware that the Pacific Ocean is pretty much boiling over. We have this massive El Nino that's heading our way with water temperatures upwards of 7 or 8 degrees greater than normal. And in fact, people are saying that never before in human history have we witnessed a Pacific weather event like the one that's about to hit us this summer and winter, which is another way to say that we're often broadsided by the unexpected, by these titanic forces that are moving all around us and at all times. And we better get used to rolling with the punches. It's a good strategy. Roll. So for those of you out there who are experiencing some new or unexpected chaos in your lives, know that I'm sitting there with you. And we can all hold one another in these times of tremendous change. For those of you who have been listening, you know that for the last couple of weeks, I've also been telling as a set of auxiliary stories a bunch of tales from the Arabian Nights, that incredible compendium of stories, ancient stories, some of the earliest stories ever told. And if for those of you who are joining us now, know that we last left off with the tale of a merchant who had run afoul of a great jinn, a great force, a great spirit, who was going to smote him dead, was going to take his life. And while the merchant sat and was waiting for his fate, one by one, three old men appeared, one leading a deer on a chain, another with two black dogs, a third man, and they all pledged to keep the merchant company while he awaited his death. And they each asked the genie, this great spirit, they said, well, if we can tell you a story more fantastical than what has befallen you, will you grant us a third of this poor merchant's blood? And the great genie, he concurred. He said, yes, I'll do this. And so the second old man, he began to tell the story of these two dogs that accompanied him. And he explained to the jinn, these two dogs, they're my brothers. And please understand that when our father died, he left each of us 1,000 dinar. And he instructed each of us to open a shop. But as soon as my older brother received this money, he dispensed with his goods and he took his 1,000 dinar and he set out to travel and to trade abroad. And he was gone for an entire year when one day a beggar presented himself to me and he came to my shop and I looked at him and I said, oh, my dear sir, my God, admit you, come in, enter. And the man looked at me and he said, am I that different? Have I changed so much? He was weeping. He said, look at me, look at my face. And I looked at the man and I realized it was my brother. So I welcomed him in and I asked what had occurred to change him. And he said, don't ask me anything. No more questions. Just know that I have nothing left. So I took him and I bathed him, and I dressed him, and I shared food with him, and I went to my accounts, and I discovered that in the time that he had been gone, I had doubled my wealth, and so I split it, and I gave him 1,000 dinar, and I said, please act as if you had never gone away, and so he took his share, and he opened up a shop. Shortly after that, my second brother, this dog here, he decided to go out and to travel and to trade as well. And we tried to dissuade him, but off he went and he joined a group of traders and he traveled for a year. And sure enough, he returned in much the same shape as his older brother. And I said, didn't I warn you? I warned you not to do this. And he said, alas, this is my fate. I now have nothing. And so once again, I bathed him and clothed him and fed him. And I looked at my accounts and I realized that once again, I had doubled my wealth. And so I split it and I shared what I had with him. We lived together. And at one point, my two brothers said to me, why don't we all go abroad? Why don't we travel and we shall trade? And I said, what can I possibly gain from this? What have you learned? Haven't you learned that this is going to come to naught? But we stayed in our shops and we continued to buy and sell. And after 6 years, I said, how have you done, my brothers? And let's see what we have. And it turns out that they had squandered everything on food and drink and on pleasures. And I found that I had multiplied my wealth 6 times. And so I said, let us take this and we'll split it all. And then I will take 2,000 dinar and I will bury them in the ground and all of us can go off and we can seek our fortunes. And they said, this is a splendid idea. So I buried the money and we boarded our ships and we set sail onto the sea. And we traveled for months on end. And we sold our goods and we earned money. And as we prepared to leave this harbor, I saw a woman. She was in rags and she was impoverished. And she kissed my hands. She begged me, will you do me a favor, please? Please, if you trust me, I will reward you. And I said to her, I will help you regardless of any reward. And she said to me, marry me, dress me. Take me to your boat and back to your country. Allow me to be your wife, and I shall give myself to you. Be kind, and you shall be repaid. And my heart, I wept for her. And so I said, yes. And I dressed her in fine clothes, and I married her, and I took her to my boat, and I spread the cloth upon the bed, and I gave her my attention. And thence we set forth and we sailed for nights and days, and I spent the days and the nights with her, and we enjoyed each other's pleasure. And then My brothers, however, they were jealous of me, and so they conspired to take my life. And at one night, as I slept beside my wife, they took me from my bed and they tossed me into the sea. And when my wife, she awoke, she herself changed into a jinn. And she came to the ocean and she bore me away to an island. And she said, I love you so, and I came to you disguised. And she said, for what your brothers have done, I must now kill them. I thanked her. I said, no, please do not do this. They're my brothers. After all, they are my brothers. And I told them the entire story of all that they had done. And she said, then I shall go and I shall sink their boats and I shall let them drown. She was so enraged. And I said, please, for God's sake, don't do this. Leave evil to the evildoers. And when I calmed her, she carried me away and she took me to my house and I dug up the money and I restored myself. I opened up my shop, but one day she returned to me and she brought with her these two dogs. And she said simply, these are your brothers. And I asked, who did this? And she said, I sent them to my sister who changed them into dogs. And they will not change back for 10 years' time. And then she told me where I could find her sister, and she departed. And now 10 years have passed, and I am on my way to have her lift this spell. And here on my way, I met this man, this poor merchant, and on learning what awaited him, I vowed that I should stay until you return, my dear jinn. This is my story. Is it not amazing? And the jinn looked and he said, so very strange. So great is your story that I grant you a third of my claim on the merchant's blood. And the third old man said, genie, don't break my heart. If I tell you a story even far stranger than the first two, will you grant me a third of your claim on his life? And the genie said, I will. And the old man said, listen. And it was then that dawn overtook Shahrazad and it cut her speaking short. And her sister Dunyazad said, what a strange story. And Shahrazad replied, if I can live yet another night, I shall tell you far stranger. And the king Shahryar said he would spare her yet another night.
Drop me down into the water. Wash my sins away. Been too long now in this sorrow. Come and carry me away. Take this burden from my shoulders. Shine your light that I might. Every day this heart grows colder. Bring your love to comfort me. Drop me down into the water. Wash my sins away.
Every day my hunger
water.
Baptism by fire, baptism by water, baptism. To wash away your old life and to be born again. Inch by inch, John laid dashed lines printed on parchment onto lath battens. He applied the glue and let it dry. He was chain smoking at the time, so stressed he was. He lost weight, assuming the gaunt frame of his subjects. Everything of this venture was indeterminate. He was making his technique up as he went and had no idea if it was working. And he had to finish. Above all, this thing had to be finished. Welcome back. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. And I'm your host, Andrew Lewis. Today, we continue on what could only be considered a journey of discovery. What great enterprise would shoulder a single infant child across prairies and through mountain ranges and down rivers into unknown territory and wilds? Little Jean-Baptiste was intended deliberately as that token by which to say that this was not a party of war, but a mission of discovery and of peace. His mother's most important charge may simply have been to carry him on her back. That spring, after the snow melt, the waters of the Missouri rose high and in places spread out across the land. The Corps of Discovery set out from Fort Mandan. The men would pull the pirogues and the boat laden with their things. They would walk the banks or up to their thighs in the freezing water. The girl and the baby would have ridden in the boat. Meriwether, however, would have walked the upper bank in order to have better vantage of their territory. Beside him, for nearly 1,000 miles, would have walked his Newfoundland dog. The Trapper Toussaint would quickly prove his lack of worth. He was profane and undisciplined. His knowledge of the native tongues was near non-existent. His knowledge of the land sketchy at best. Not least of all, he didn't know how to swim. William Clark, the co-captain of the expedition, would have let him go if not for one thing, the value of his girl companion. Although there is scant mention of the Indian girl in the journals, Lewis recorded that at least initially the two interpreters and the girl and the baby would sleep in the teepee reserved for the two captains. The girl and the infant would need protection, but this simple fact also suggests the value which they, and in particular her tongue, held for the Corps of Discovery expedition. On May 14, 1805, on the Upper Missouri, Toussaint was temporarily at the helm of one of the pirogues that contained the trip journals, scientific instruments, books, medicines, and trading goods. But he could neither sail nor swim, and so when the sail was hit by a strong wind, he panicked and lofted into the wind and lost control of the boat and rudder, and the boat keeled over. Strong waves lapped over the bow and filled the boat to the gunwales with water. Lewis shouted and fired his gun from the shore, Toussaint pleading to God for mercy. In that moment, Lewis saw the entire mission coming to an end. Without the instruments, the journals, the trading merchandise, they could scarcely continue. Lewis ran to the shore to strip his clothes, to throw himself into the freezing waters, to swim the 300 yards to the sinking boat. The crew members ordered Toussaint to take control of the rudder, but he froze and could not do so until another member of the corps threatened to shoot Toussaint dead on the spot if he didn't. The boat righted, the crew members set to bailing. But all the while, the young Shoshone girl, with her baby tied to her body, was reaching into the water and retrieving the wooden boxes and bundles that were floating away in the river. She saved a good measure of the most valuable things in the boat. The drawings, the lists of words, the medicines, the maps and cartographic records, and not least of all, the precious journals. 2 days later, Lewis noted that the actions of the Indian woman, who possessed fortitude and resolution equal to that of any man on the boat. 4 days later, Captain Lewis christened a wide blue stream, Sacagawea. She would have been told that her name had been bestowed upon the land.
Yes, somewhere on the desert highway,
Midsummer at the Great Falls of the Missouri, the Indian girl took sick and curled up in pain. Clark was scared for her life. He bled her and treated her with a poultice of water, bran, and cinchona bark, which she applied to her genitals. The fate of the expedition was dependent on the well-being of this mother and this child. She would have still been nursing. If she died, they would have had no way to feed the infant. The travelers were unlike anything this country had ever seen. It was an American clown show, a traveling circus making its way across the land. Most of the men were pale, except one who looked as if he had been scorched by fire. The Indian women would take particular interest in him. His hair was like that of a buffalo, as if he were a chimera, half man and half beast. The journals report how, on more than a few occasions, warriors readily offered up their wives to have sex with him so that he could invest them with his power. And then there was Tsukwazui and a squalling child. And lastly, there was the dog. That was perhaps not a dog, so large he was, like a bear. The land they encountered was peopled, and word would have preceded them, band to band, of their eventual arrival. It seemed to be that they were unaligned with any of the warring tribes, and they had guns that were of value. When they came across new people, at times the girl and the baby would proceed first. She would speak and motion for them. The softness of language or gesture might impress that they came in peace. Or perhaps it was just her presence as a native girl. They were seeking passage to an ocean. Their chief would present gifts, payments for the right to pass through their land. And over long conversations translated through three languages and gestures, Meriwether Lewis would tell them of their great chief who wished to make acquaintance with all people. When Tsukwazui presented herself with her infant, she implied, "We are of you. This is your native son." She would have been received generously in this way, but a dilemma remains. Toussaint was no great catch. On the 14th of August, 1805, Clark had to intervene when he found him beating the squaw. Within a couple days, Tsukwazui would eventually be reunited with her Shoshone people. But when it was time for the Corps of Discovery to continue, she did not stay behind. Her usefulness to the Corps had ended, and yet she continued to travel with them. And on the return, they passed once more through Shoshone country, and again she journeyed away from her world. So there's another story. It was not her desire for adventure or even contractual obligations that had driven her on. She was bound to a French scoundrel who was disrespected by the other members of the Corps, and she was traveling with strangers who spoke languages of which she had no knowledge, to travel into an unknown world. So why did she continue? The truth was, she had been rejected. And there's even more. Her Shoshone name, Mudthrower, was the name you might give to a child She had not been initiated into adulthood, into her adult name, and so she had none. In the Shoshone world, she would have still been received as a child. And there are stories, even to this day, that her manner was different. In the future, some of her people would not remember her as a hero or even one of their own. She had the ways of the white skins, they would say. She was boastful. She talked of the things that she had seen, things perhaps that she had done. She would want to prove her merit, but in the end, this would do the exact opposite. She did not fully know the cultural ways of her people. And she had brought these strangers to them, the people who would hunt out the land and who would change their lives forever. So Guizui would learn that her birth family was gone. And it was recorded in the journals that the Shoshone man to whom she had been pledged when she was younger no longer wanted her. We can assume also that she would no longer have been fluent in her language, and what fluency she did have would have been the vocabulary of a 10-year-old child. This suggests then a different kind of courage, because this girl was as alone as any creature might be in this world. Not only did she not live within her own language, she may not have fully inhabited any language at all. She was not fluent in French, nor in whatever patois her husband muttered, nor in English. The breadth of her inner life was focused instead on the mechanics of her living, the tending to her child, the foraging of food, the pleasuring of her husband, the receiving of temperature and light and moisture and color and smells, the opportunity for her to communicate with her hands or through the facial expressions the nature of her joy or her anger. She was the only woman in the company of men. Thank you.
girl, where will you go? I'm going where the cold wind blows. In the pines, where the sun don't ever shine. I would shiver the whole night through.
Far to the west, the Clatsop people. They waited. They had stories. A shipwreck. The coming of the spotted disease. Great dying. By 1792, when the American captain and privateer Robert Gray piloted his ship, the Columbia Redivivva, into Tillamook Bay and pinned down for the first time the mouth of what would be named the Columbia River, the native populations had already been depleted. 10 days after setting anchor, he would leave with over 300 beaver and 150 sea otter pelts. On that voyage, Gray was quick to fire upon native boats. Later, further north, he would burn a village of 200 buildings to the ground. Over the next 12 years, until 1804, over 60 ships stopped to trade at the mouth of the Columbia. In 1805, on his birthday, on August 18th, Lewis wrote in his journal, "This day, I completed my 31st year and conceived that I had, in all human probability, now existed about half the period which I am to remain in this sublunary world. I reflected that I had as yet done but little, very little indeed, to further the happiness of the human race or to advance the information of the succeeding generation. I viewed with great regret that many hours I have spent in indolence, and now sorely feel the want of that information which these hours would have given me had they been judiciously expended." Once the party crossed the Bitterroots and from the Snake onto the Columbia, they began the long and steep descent toward the Western Ocean. They recorded seeing along the banks the abandoned and decimated villages, barren of people. They floated past funerary platforms on which were wrapped corpses that the carrion had picked clean. They floated past fishing weirs stinking of rotting dead fish. In these places, the people were already gone. By 1850, half to perhaps 95% of the population would be disappeared by disease. At the mouth of the Columbia, the Corps members needed to choose a location to overwinter. Some men wanted the opposite bank. So Aguizui seemed to have expressed forcefully that she wanted to be close to the water and roots. Each member of the Corps was allowed to vote. That day, in the fall of 1805, may perhaps be the first instance of a slave man and a woman and an Indian being granted suffrage. People came to them to trade that winter, and eventually to steal. Clark noticed that a number bore the scars of smallpox. A Chinook woman had lamp-blacked on her arm the name J. Bowman, branded by an American or British sailor that had perhaps carried the pox and infected the people upriver. By Christmas, the Corps had left scarcely any provisions. Clark distributed handkerchiefs of the remaining tobacco as small gifts. The Christmas feast consisted of dried roots and spoiled elk. Spirits were glum, the rain unceasing. Their leathers were rotting. But on Christmas Day, the native woman gave to Clark a present that he barely noted in passing. She presented to him 24 white ermine tails. But for the gift giver, consider this. Those 24 white tails, pure as snow, they signified a chief. This great gift did not come from the mouth of the Columbia. Nor would she have had the time to collect these tails on the journey downriver. She had instead carried them all the way from the Bitterroots, where she would have received them from her own relations. They were that precious totem that bound her to her own people. Aside from the clothes on her body, they were the only possession that she had. She had secreted them until this moment, on Christmas Day, the day of a Lord and Savior of whom she had no knowing and would never know. And now she gave the ermine away.
Drink up, baby, stay up all night with the things you could do. You won't, but you might. The potential you'll be that you'll never see. The promises you'll only make. Drink up with me now and forget all about the pressure of days. Do what I say. Make you okay and drive them away. The images stuck in your head. People you've been before that you don't want around anymore. That push and shove and won't bend to your will. I'll keep them still. Drink up, baby.
Fort Clatsop winter was bitter. In January, Chinook, who came to trade, spoke of a beast from the sea that had washed up on the beach. Clark organized an expedition across the bluffs to see this creature. Tsawgwisawip was told to stay behind, but the young girl that she was, she threw a tantrum, throwing all manner of incomprehensible words into the air. She had traveled all this way to see the edge of the earth and the endless sea. She wanted to see the monster, the creature that had come to visit them from there, and this she would not be denied. Clark relented. The party traveled for 2 days, climbing a 1,500-foot bluff to get there. The one-year-old infant Jean-Baptiste, who one day, like all, would become a ghost, was then bound in cloth, rocking to sleep, seeking eyes, peering outward, back toward the path just traveled, or else over the shoulder toward what lay ahead. They arrived on the beach on a clear, cold morning to find the blue whale gutted, the blubber and innards cut away. What flesh remained was rotting on the bones. Tsawgwisawip would have walked its length. She would have run her hands across its fouled and brindled bones, jeweled with flies. The fish mother had died. Without the mother that spawns the fish, would the fish, would they still come? What would it be like to be swallowed by such a thing? She might have stepped beneath that vaulted cage, knelt in the sand and flesh rot, and undoubtedly turned her gaze upward. The cannoning roar of surf, sucking whisper against the sand. The ivory boughs like curving lattice framing a boundless ocean and cold blue sky. Baptiste's head turned to the gray blue sea, the breakers thundering on the shore. In whatever Creole was hers, she would have spoken to her baby. We don't know what was said. Perhaps this is where we go. Perhaps this is from where we come. Little man, Bampe. And it was on that day that one-year-old baby came to gaze out at the Pacific, peering over his mother's shoulder. As the youngest member of the Corps of Discovery, as the human shield and the offering that had allowed them to proceed unmolested through a foreign country, as an infant, he had traveled the length of a continent, bound to his mother's back. By spring 1806, after the snowmelt, the soldiers of the Corps had eaten through their boot leather and were diuretic and sick. They made their way back upriver, over the Bitterroots, and down the Snake, and to the Missouri. And from there, the river flowed quick and carried the crew fast to St. Louis in a matter of months. And there they would arrive with their tales to tell.
To. Early she had to die, trying she she was gonna keep. Oh yeah, alright. Take it easy, baby, make it last all night. She was an American girl. Well, it was kind of cold that night. She stood alone on her balcony. She could hear the cars roll by. He crept back in her memory. God, it's so painful when something so close is still so far out of reach. Oh, yeah. All right. Take it easy, baby. Make it last all night. She was an American girl. Oh, yeah.
You have been listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. And this is your host, Andrew Lewis. Thank you for joining us on this long journey. This journey that you might begin to feel is without end, but worry not, all good stories do come to an end. Thanks again to Chris Lothar and Drusilla Gould of the Shoshone Language Project out of the University of Utah, who were able to provide the pronunciation of Sacagawea's name. Any pronunciations are, of course, my own, and I hope I'll be forgiven for her great service and ultimately great sacrifice to our nation. Sacagawea deserves her name. If you'd like to know more about the Corps of Discovery, I again encourage you to go straight to the source. Moulton's compiled collection of all the journals, fully transcribed, are available digitally and are fully searchable. The writings of Meriwether Lewis, William Clark, and the other members of the Corps are one of the great American bequests. We open today with Drop Me Down by Tres Chicas, Unknown Legend by the great Neil Young, and performed by Shovel and Rope and Shaky Graves. Where Did You Sleep Last Night, performed by Nirvana live and unplugged in New York, one of Kurt Cobain's great gifts to us. Between the Bars by the dear Elliot Smith, who took himself away from us when he was far too young. American Girl, sung by Tom Petty and recorded live at the Fillmore in 1997. We'll walk you out with All the Lilacs in Ohio, sung by John Hiatt with Jerry Douglas on resonator guitar. I strongly encourage you to please, please, please subscribe to The Mountain on Substack. The link can be found in the episode description, or you can just Google The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and the Substack will come up, as long as possibly the Spotify podcast version of this rambling story. If you want to get caught up, I recommend you go there and listen to the back episodes. Also, the Substack will be the best way to stay notified when next episodes drop, as well as to receive new kinds of content not available on Spotify or the radio, and to be apprised of all things Mountain. And by all means, if you enjoyed the listen and it makes your world a little bigger, I would be grateful and indebted if you would share with your friends. Please have a great day or a good night, wherever you are.
When you met her there on the New York City stair, you were throwing up on your shoe, trying to write the great book when it really had you it's a winter time blue. So you drank her down to the ragged side of town, shared a taxi to carry her home. Then she left her handkerchief there beside you on the seat, as if to emphasize that you were all alone. Smelled like springtime when you were just a boy. Tales. Your story often fails. You're close, but no cigar. You might see your own ass in a double whiskey glass, but you cannot erase her smile. And you'll never write it down, never find her in this town. A phantom dreams and fingernail files. It was springtime, and you were just a boy. Your bed and crawl in. You imagine her there, and you're tangled in her hair, and she smells like flowers again. And it's springtime, and you are just a boy. All the lilacs in Ohio, all the lilacs in Ohio. There you go, in the city streets, in the dirty winter snow.
Two shows tonight?
Yeah. I'll be and use up your Bible statistics.